Aided to the association by native chiefs, roads have been opened, steamboats have been placed on the river, and the nuclei of states established, under one flag which offers freedom to commerce and prohibits the slave trade. The objects of the society are philanthropic. It does not aim at permanent political control, but seeks the neutrality of the valley. Leopold was delighted to hear his own propaganda coming so readily from the president's mouth. His aide, Colonel Maximilian Strauch, cabled Sanford, enchanted with Emile. Sanford next went to work on Congress. He rented a house at 1925 G Street, a few blocks from the White House, telegraphed for his wife and chef to come over from Belgium, and began wining and dining senators, representatives, and cabinet members. It was Sanford's finest hour, for the affable personality that made him both a bon vivant and a poor businessman served him wonderfully as a lobbyist. He had an excellent wine cellar, and he was called the gastronomic diplomat, waging a gastronomic campaign. "What a charming dinner that was at your house, and in such a queenly presence, too," one visitor wrote to him. Secretary of State Frelinghuysen was a frequent guest. President Arthur and members of Congress and the Cabinet found themselves receiving boxes of Florida oranges. As he was winning congressional support for Leopold's claim to the Congo, Sanford discovered an unexpected ally. Senator John Tyler Morgan of Alabama, a former Confederate brigadier general, was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Like most white Southern politicians of the era, he was frightened by the specter of millions of freed slaves and their descendants harboring threatening dreams of equality. The fierce-looking mustachioed senator, small in stature but loud in bluster, thundered ominously about the dangers of enforced Negro rule as blacks were foisted into white families where they might inflict a worse fate than death upon an innocent woman. Morgan fretted for years over the problem of this growing black population. His solution, endorsed by many, was simple. Send them back to Africa. Always urging a general exodus of Southern blacks, at various times in his long career, Morgan also advocated sending them to Hawaii, to Cuba, and to the Philippines, which, perhaps because the islands were so far away, he claimed were a native home of the Negro. But Africa was always first choice. To Morgan, Leopold's new state seemed heaven-sent. Wouldn't this territory require manpower to develop? And wouldn't the Congolese be eager to trade with the United States if the Americans they met had the same skin color? And couldn't the Congo become a market for the South's cotton surplus? Africa, he later said on the Senate floor, was prepared for the Negro as certainly as the Garden of Eden was prepared for Adam and Eve. In the Congo Basin we find the best type of the Negro race, and the American Negro can find here the field for his efforts. Sanford completely agreed. Although he was born in Connecticut, once he invested in the South, he quickly assimilated the send-them-back-to-Africa feelings of white businessmen there. The Congo could serve, he had said, as an outlet for the enterprise and ambition of our colored people in more congenial fields than politics. To the end of his life he would promote this new Canaan for our modern Israelites, which could be the ground to draw the gathering electricity from that black cloud spreading over the southern states. Sanford and Morgan hit it off splendidly, and Morgan, too, began receiving crates of Florida oranges. In early 1884, Morgan introduced a Senate resolution in support of Leopold's Congo claims, first sending a rough draft to Sanford. Like any lobbyist given the chance, Sanford reached for more. To Morgan's reference to land drained by the Congo River, he added the words, "its tributaries and adjacent rivers," a phrase that could be interpreted as meaning all of Central Africa. The Senate toned this down, soon passing a modified version of Morgan's resolution. It also issued 1,000 copies of a long report on the Congo under Morgan's name, mainly written by Sanford. "It may be safely asserted," the report declared, "that no barbarous people have ever so readily adopted the fostering care of benevolent enterprise as have the tribes of the Congo, and never was there a more honest and practical effort made to secure their welfare." Knowing how carefully President Arthur's Republicans listened to business, Sanford got the New York Chamber of Commerce to pass a resolution endorsing U.S. recognition of Leopold's association. Favorable accounts of the king's philanthropic work began appearing in major American newspapers, stimulated, in the fashion of the day, by quiet payments from Sanford. Sanford's multi-layered campaign was probably the most sophisticated piece of Washington lobbying on behalf of a foreign ruler in the 19th century, and on April 22, 1884, it bore fruit. The Secretary of State declared that the United States of America recognized King Leopold II's claim to the Congo. It was the first country to do so. Leopold knew he owed this great coup to Sanford, and knew also that what mattered more than money to the general was royal praise. He invited to breakfast Sanford's wife Gertrude, who had returned to Belgium. "I cannot begin to tell you," she wrote to her husband afterward, "of all the flattering things the king said about you. My dear, nothing could have been more flattering to you or tender to me than were both the king and queen." During his adroit Washington lobbying, Sanford had passed around documents that thoroughly jumbled the names of the International Association of the Congo, entirely controlled by Leopold, and the International African Association, at this point defunct, but still vaguely remembered as a philanthropic society of famous explorers, crown princes, and grand dukes. Everyone was left pleasantly confused. In his official statement of recognition, Secretary of State Frelinghuysen actually managed to use both names in the same sentence. "The government of the United States announces its sympathy with and approval of the humane and benevolent purposes of the International Association of the Congo, administering, as it does, the interests of the free states there established, and will order the officers of the United States, both on land and sea, to recognize the flag of the International African Association as the flag of a friendly government." Like most such official documents, this one rapidly disappeared into bureaucrats' filing cabinets. But it was later transformed, in a curious way that no one seems to have noticed. When this very statement was reprinted the following year in Stanley's best-selling The Congo and the Founding of Its Free State, a story of work and exploration, which was translated into many languages and read all over the world, the wording was different. The key change was that it referred only to Leopold's wholly-owned International Association of the Congo. The editor who made the change was most likely the king himself, who carefully corrected Stanley's manuscript chapter by chapter. Long before Stalin, who also edited writers' manuscripts with his own hand, Leopold knew the uses of rewriting history. "The recognition of the United States was the birth unto new life of the association," wrote Stanley, and he was right. Meanwhile, as Sanford was preparing to return in triumph to Belgium, Leopold closed a similar deal in France. As in Washington, the king had his own man in Paris, a well-connected art dealer named Arthur Stevens. He negotiated directly with Premier Jules Ferry, while Leopold paid a large monthly stipend to a journalist from the influential Le Temps to ensure a stream of sympathetic articles about his activities in the Congo. The French did not feel threatened by tiny Belgium or by the vast size of Leopold's claims. Their main fear was that when the king ran out of money, as they were sure he would, in his expensive plan to build a railway around the rapids, he might sell the whole territory to their main colonial rival, England. After all, hadn't Stanley repeatedly pressed for a British Congo? Leopold calculated that Stanley's impulsive Anglophile fusillades might now actually be helping him. "It is my judgment," the king had confided to Colonel Strauch some months earlier, after one such salvo from Stanley, "that we should not try to make a correction. It does no harm for Paris to fear that a British protectorate could be established in the Congo." To allay the French anxiety, Leopold offered a remedy. If France would respect his claim, he would give the country droit de préférence over the Congo, what real estate lawyers today call a right of first refusal. The French, relieved, quickly agreed. Confident that Leopold's planned railway would bankrupt him and that he would then have to sell them the land, they thought they were getting an excellent deal. The Americans had been so charmed by Sanford's bonhomie that they had not bothered to specify the exact borders of the distant territory they were implicitly recognizing as Leopold's. France, on the other hand, was willing to draw these boundaries on a map, where they included most of the Congo River Basin. Leopold had used the words "independent states" in writing to President Arthur, but in his pronouncements over the next few months this became "state." As for the association, that was purely a temporary body and would disappear when its work was completed, said a Belgian journalist in 1884, explaining the king's thinking. By such sleight of hand, the entity that came to be recognized by a lengthening list of countries over the following year gradually changed from a federation of states under the benevolent protection of a charitable society to one colony ruled by one man. Leopold found that the hardest nut to crack was Chancellor Bismarck of Germany. At first, the king's greed got him in trouble. Besides the Congo Basin, he wrote to Bismarck, he was claiming vaguely defined areas abandoned by Egypt, where the slave trade continues to flourish. To allow these provinces to be incorporated into and administered by a new state would be the best way to get at the root of the trouble and eradicate it. Bismarck, no fool, scribbled a comment in the margin beside this passage, "Swindle." Beside a passage about a confederation of free states, he put, "Fantasies." When Leopold wrote that the precise frontiers of the new state or states would be defined later, Bismarck said to an aide, "His Majesty displays the pretensions and naive selfishness of an Italian who considers that his charm and good looks will enable him to get away with anything." In the end, though, Leopold outsmarted even the Iron Chancellor, once again by working through the perfect intermediary. Gerson Bleichroeder, Bismarck's banker, the financier of the St. Gotthard Tunnel under the Alps and many other projects, was a man of much behind-the-scenes influence in Berlin. The king had met him some years earlier at the fashionable Belgian beach resort of Ostend, and had identified him as someone he could make use of. Bleichroeder quietly bought goodwill for Leopold by conveying a 40,000-franc royal contribution to Berlin's Africa Society. He reported to Brussels on the latest doings at court in the city, and eventually he brought his friend the Chancellor around to accepting Leopold's claim to the Congo. In return, Bleichroeder received some banking business from advisers to Leopold and the chance to invest in the Congo himself. A woman pianist, thought to be a romantic interest of his, was invited to give a recital at the Belgian court, where she was presented with a medal by Leopold. The king's negotiations with Bismarck reached a climax soon after Stanley returned to Europe in the summer of 1884. For 5 days the explorer was the guest of Leopold, now on holiday at Ostend's Royal Chalet, a sprawling seaside villa studded with turrets and towers. The king brought in a special cook to make Stanley a traditional English breakfast each morning, and the two men talked far into the night. Just as Stanley was about to leave, came a message from Bismarck with questions about the boundaries of the new Congo state, so Stanley remained for a few hours to draw them in on a large map on the wall of the king's study. Bismarck let himself be convinced that it was better for the Congo to go to the king of weak little Belgium and be open to German traders than go to protection-minded France or Portugal or to powerful England. In return for guarantees of freedom of trade in the Congo, like everyone else, Bismarck did not know the full text of Leopold's treaties with the chiefs. He agreed to recognize the new state. In Europe, the thirst for African land had become nearly palpable. There were some conflicting claims to be resolved, and clearly some ground rules were needed for further division of the African cake. Bismarck offered to host a diplomatic conference in Berlin to discuss some of these issues. To Leopold, the conference was one more opportunity to tighten his grip on the Congo. On November 15, 1884, representatives of the powers of Europe assembled at a large, horseshoe-shaped table overlooking the garden of Bismarck's yellow-brick official residence on the Wilhelmstrasse. The ministers and plenipotentiaries in formal attire who took their seats beneath the room's vaulted ceiling and sparkling chandelier included counts, barons, colonels, and a vizier from the Ottoman Empire. Bismarck, wearing scarlet court dress, welcomed them in French, the diplomatic lingua franca, and seated before a large map of Africa, the delegates got to work. More than anyone, Stanley had ignited the great African land rush, but even he felt uneasy about the greed in the air. It reminded him, he said, of how my black followers used to rush with gleaming knives for slaughtered game during our travels. The Berlin Conference was the ultimate expression of an age whose newfound enthusiasm for democracy had clear limits, and slaughtered game had no vote. Even John Stuart Mill, the great philosopher of human freedom, had written in On Liberty, "Despotism is a legitimate mode of government in dealing with barbarians, provided the end be their improvement." Not a single African was at the table in Berlin. With his embryonic state already recognized by the United States and Germany, and with his friendly right-of-first-refusal deal made with France, Leopold was in a strong position. His International Association of the Congo was not a government. In fact, conference delegates seemed confused as to just what it was, so it was not officially represented at Berlin. But Leopold had no problem staying abreast of what went on at the conference. To begin with, keeping a close ear to the ground in the German capital was his friend Bleichroeder, who was host of the delegates at an elegant dinner. Further, the king had ties with no fewer than three of the national delegations. First, the Belgian representatives were his trusted underlings. One of them was appointed secretary of the meeting. Second, Leopold was unusually well informed about confidential matters in the British Foreign Office, because the Foreign Secretary's personal assistant owed a large sum of money to a businessman friend of the King's who had been one of his original co-investors in sending Stanley to the Congo. In addition, a legal adviser to the British delegation was Sir Travers Twiss, who had recently consulted for Leopold about his treaties with the Congo chiefs. Finally, who was appointed as one of two American delegates to the conference? None other than Henry Shelton Sanford, who sent Leopold informative dispatches almost daily. And who was technical adviser to the American delegation, even as he remained on Leopold's payroll? Henry Morton Stanley. Between sessions of the conference, Leopold sent Sanford to Paris and Stanley to London on diplomatic lobbying missions. Although his role at Berlin was mainly as a figurehead for Leopold's Congo ambitions, Stanley was lionized by everyone and had a splendid time. "This evening I had the honor of dining with Prince Bismarck and his family," he wrote in his journal. "The prince is a great man, a kind father, and excellently simple with his family. The prince asked many questions about Africa and proved to me that in a large way he understood the condition of that continent very well." Bismarck, acquiring the beginnings of a substantial African empire for Germany, was glad to have the famous explorer stimulate German interest in the continent. He arranged for Stanley a round of banquets and lectures in Cologne, Frankfurt, and Wiesbaden. In snowy Berlin, almost none of the conference participants except Stanley had seen more of Africa than the drawings of its scenery on the menus for Bismarck's banquets. So when anyone seemed unclear about why Leopold's claim was so grand, Stanley could speak with the authority of someone who had just spent 5 years in the Congo for the king. "Early on," reported one diplomat, "Stanley went to the big map of Africa and immediately engrossed the interest of every delegate by a vivid description of the features of the Congo basin, and finally of the adjacent country necessary to go with it under the same regime to secure the utmost freedom of communication." Telegrams zipped back and forth between Berlin and Brussels, where Leopold was following every move. Contrary to myth, the Berlin Conference did not partition Africa. The spoils were too large, and it would take many more treaties to divide them all. But by resolving some conflicting claims, the conference, and a separate pact the king negotiated with France, did help Leopold in one important way. The king, France, and Portugal each got land near the Congo River's mouth. But Leopold got what he most wanted, the seaport of Matadi on the lower stretch of the river, and the land he needed to build a railway from there around the rapids to Stanley Pool. More important to Leopold was the web of bilateral agreements he made with other countries during and after the conference, recognizing his colony in the making and marking out its boundaries. When talking to the British, for instance, he hinted that if he didn't get all the land he had in mind, he would leave Africa completely, which would mean, under his right-of-first-refusal deal, that he would sell the Congo to France. The bluff worked, and England gave in. Europeans were still used to thinking of Africa's wealth mainly in terms of its coastline, and there was remarkably little conflict over ceding to Leopold the vast spaces he wanted in the interior. A major reason he was able to get his hands on so much is that other countries thought that they were giving their approval to a sort of international colony, under the auspices of the King of the Belgians, to be sure, but open to traders from all of Europe. In addition to perfunctory nods in favour of freedom of navigation, arbitration of differences, Christian missionaries and the like, the major agreement that came out of Berlin was that a huge swath of Central Africa, including Leopold's territory in the Congo Basin, would be a free trade zone. The conference ended in February 1885 with signatures on an agreement and a final round of speechmaking. No one benefited more than the man who had not been there, King Leopold II. At the mention of his name during the signing ceremony, the audience rose and applauded. In his closing speech to the delegates, Chancellor Bismarck said, The new Congo state is destined to be one of the most important executors of the work we intend to do, and I express my best wishes for its speedy development and for the realization of the noble aspirations of its illustrious creator. 2 months later, like a delayed exclamation mark at the end of Bismarck's speech, a United States naval vessel, the Lancaster, appeared at the mouth of the Congo River and fired a 21-gun salute in honor of the blue flag with the gold star. Most Belgians had paid little attention to their king's flurry of African diplomacy, but once it was over, they began to realize, with surprise, that his new colony was bigger than England, France, Germany, Spain, and Italy combined. It was 1/13 of the African continent, more than 76 times the size of Belgium itself. To make clear the distinction between his two roles, the King of the Belgians at first considered calling himself Emperor of the Congo. He also toyed with the idea of outfitting loyal chiefs with uniforms modelled on those of the famous red-clad beef-eaters at the Tower of London. Then he decided to be merely the Congo's King Sovereign. In later years, Leopold several times referred to himself, more accurately, for his main interest in the territory was in extracting every possible penny of wealth, as the Congo's proprietor. His power as King Sovereign of the colony was shared in no way with the Belgian government, whose cabinet ministers were as surprised as anyone when they opened their newspapers to find that the Congo had promulgated a new law or signed a new international treaty. Even though the entity officially recognized by the Berlin Conference and various governments had been the International African Association or the International Association of the Congo, or in the case of the befuddled U.S. State Department, both, Leopold decided on yet another change of name. The pretense that there was a philanthropic association involved in the Congo was allowed to evaporate. All that remained unchanged was the blue flag with the gold star. By royal decree, on May 29, 1885, the king named his new, privately controlled country the État indépendant du Congo, the Congo Free State. Soon there was a national anthem towards the future. At last, at age 50, Leopold had the colony he had long dreamed of. Chapter 6. Under the Yacht Club Flag. While his power overseas was on the rise, at home Leopold's family life grew worse. He increasingly found refuge in the beds of various mistresses, one of whom Belgians promptly nicknamed Queen of the Congo. In April 1885, only 6 weeks after his diplomatic triumph at Berlin, the king was named in a British courtroom as one of the clients of a high-class, disorderly house prosecuted at the urging of the London Committee for the Suppression of the Continental Traffic in English Girls. Leopold had paid £800 a month, a former servant of the house testified, for a steady supply of young women, some of whom were 10 to 15 years old and guaranteed to be virgins. A Paris newspaper reported rumours that Leopold had secretly crossed to England in his yacht and paid a royal sum to the house's madam to be sure his name was not mentioned again. More likely, what made the case close with unusual speed was that the Prince of Wales was said to be another of the establishment's customers. The British Home Secretary sent a special observer to the court, apparently a veiled message to all concerned that the less said, the better. After pleading guilty, the madam of the house got off with a remarkably light fine. When she was 17, Leopold married off his eldest daughter, Louise, to a much older Austro-Hungarian prince. After citywide festivities, the couple's wedding night at Laeken was so traumatic that Louise fled into the Chateau Gardens in her nightgown and had to be retrieved by a servant and lectured on wifely duty by her mother. Some years later, she got caught up in a tangle of bad debts and an adulterous romance with a cavalry officer. After the officer fought a duel with her husband, Austrian authorities jailed him and gave Louise the choice of going back to her husband or entering an insane asylum. She chose the asylum, and Leopold refused to speak to her again. Afraid of further embarrassment, he urged that she be guarded more closely. At last, the cavalry officer was released from jail and dramatically rescued Louise from custody, only to die not long afterward. For the rest of her unhappy life, Louise bought clothes in the same obsessional way in which her father tried to buy countries, a compulsion that ate up her share of the royal fortune and more. Her exasperated creditors finally managed to seize and auction off a portion of her wardrobe. 68 veils, 90 hats, 27 evening gowns, 21 silk or velvet cloaks, and 58 umbrellas and parasols. Nor was Leopold a better father to his middle daughter, Stephanie. When she was only 16, he betrothed her to black-bearded Crown Prince Rudolf of Austria-Hungary so that she would one day become the Empress. Leopold particularly envied the Habsburgs because, unlike him, they were little encumbered by parliaments and constitutions. However, in what proved to be an omen of things to come, Rudolf, arriving in Brussels to meet Stephanie for the first time, brought his current mistress with him. The king's main relief from domestic misery was his new colony. The Congo, later recalled Louise, was the one topic of conversation around me. And, compared to his household, for Leopold, things in the Congo ran more smoothly. Just as he had found the perfect political moment to acquire his new territory, so he found himself at the right technological moment to consolidate his grip on it. As he prepared to develop the enormous colony, he found a number of tools at his disposal that had not been available to empire builders of earlier times. The tools were crucial, for they would soon allow a few thousand white men working for the king to dominate some 20 million Africans. To begin with, there was weaponry. The primitive muzzle loaders, which were the best arms that most Congolese could obtain, were little better than the muskets of George Washington's army. Starting in the late 1860s, however, Europeans could rely on breech-loading rifles, which had just shown their deadly power on the battlefields of the American Civil War. These shot much farther and more accurately, and, instead of needing loose gunpowder, which was useless in the rain, they used quick-loading waterproof brass cartridges. An even more decisive advance quickly followed, the repeating rifle, which could fire a dozen or more shots without being reloaded. Soon after came the machine gun. As the poet Hilaire Belloc wrote, "Whatever happens, we have got the Maxim gun, and they have not." Another tool that allowed Europeans to seize virtually all of tropical Africa in the 2 decades that followed the Berlin Conference was medical knowledge. Mid-century explorers had blamed malaria on everything from marshy exhalations to sleeping in the moonlight. But whatever its cause, they learned that quinine was a useful defense. Around the turn of the century, malaria and hematuria became better understood. Researchers also mastered yellow fever and other diseases, and the awesomely high death rate for Europeans in the African tropics began to drop. Finally, because of the Congo's unusual geography, one tool was even more important to Leopold than to other imperialists, and we have already seen it in action, the steamboat. It was known to Congo Africans as the house that walks on water, or after its sound as Kutu Kutu. The steamboat was an instrument of colonization throughout the 19th century, serving everyone from the British on the Ganges in India to the Russians on the Ob and Irtysh in Siberia. Congo's steamboats included both sidewheelers and sternwheelers, all had awnings against the tropical sun. Usually they were long and narrow, with the shallow draft needed to clear the innumerable sandbars on the main river and its tributaries. Sometimes wire netting hung from the awning to protect the captain and helmsman from arrows. By now, steam had also largely replaced sail on the high sea, making the long voyage from Europe down the coast of Africa far swifter and closer to a fixed schedule. These steamships carried the next wave of Leopold's agents to Africa. By the end of 1889, there were 430 whites working in the Congo, traders, soldiers, missionaries, and administrators of the king's embryonic state. Fewer than half of them were Belgians, for Leopold's homeland still showed little interest in its king's new possession. Significantly, almost all Leopold's agents in the Congo were officers on extended leave from the Belgian or other European armies. Staff in place and tools in hand, Leopold set out to build the infrastructure necessary to exploit his colony. A rudimentary Congo transportation system was the first item on his agenda. Without it, the territory's riches, whatever they might turn out to be, could not be brought to the sea except on foot. In 1887, a party of surveyors began to chart the route for a railroad to skirt the notorious 220 miles of rapids. Mosquitoes, heat, fever, and the rocky landscape laced with deep ravines took a severe toll, and it was 3 years before workers could start laying tracks. As such work began getting underway, a Congo state bureaucracy grew in Belgium, as well as in the colony itself. Henry Shelton Sanford tried to get himself a job as a top colonial executive in Brussels, writing hopefully to his wife, "There is just the sort of work I would like, with both reputation and money to gain and the satisfaction of doing good. I think I will propose a plan of operations and offer my services." His hopes were in vain, for Leopold knew that Sanford's ability to give sumptuous Washington dinner parties was not matched by talent as an administrator or by the ruthlessness the king would require. Instead, Leopold gave Sanford permission to gather ivory and other products in the Congo, and the promise of help, not followed through on, as it turned out, in the form of porters, buildings, and steamboat transportation. But the Sanford Exploring Expedition, as the venture was euphemistically called, soon went the way of Sanford's other businesses. As usual, he tried to manage everything from Belgium, where mounting debts forced him to sell off some of his art collection and move to a smaller chateau. Meanwhile, his man in charge in the Congo took to drink, while steamboat boilers rusted on the trail side. Leopold was a far better businessman than Sanford, but he too began to find himself under financial pressure. He had inherited a sizable fortune, yet by the late 1880s, explorers, steamboats, mercenaries, armaments, and other Congo expenses had burned up almost all of it. All these expenses, however, would continue, even increase, if he hoped to turn a profit in exploiting the territory. Where was the money to come from? Getting it from the Belgian government would be difficult, because a clause in the country's constitution had required parliamentary approval for Leopold to become monarch of another state. To obtain this approval, he had to promise that the Congo would never be a financial drain on Belgium. He had convinced skeptical legislators that he had sufficient funds to develop the territory, even though this was not true. From 1885 to 1890, the king spent much of his time looking for money. For a while, he was able to borrow from bankers, but in time, even his main creditors, the Rothschilds, would not lend him more. Hundreds of his letters from this period show an obsessive concern with money. He lost weight and sleep. His ministers thought he looked grey and distracted. He was known for his enormous appetite. He often ordered a new entree after finishing a big meal, and at a Paris restaurant once ate two entire roast pheasants. And in a bid for public sympathy and funds, he let it be known that to economize he was eating one less course daily at lunch. One day Queen Marie-Henriette cried out, "Leopold, you're going to ruin us with your Congo." The king raised some money through selling bonds, although far less than he had hoped. He wrote to the Pope, urging the Catholic Church to buy Congo bonds to encourage the spread of Christ's word. To the railway and a few other projects, he was able to attract private investors, but on terms that diminished his own share of what he was sure would be vast profits. He decided that the only solution to his financial crisis was a massive loan. Given his already heavy burden of debt, the most likely source for such a loan was the Belgian Parliament. As time passed, Leopold hoped, legislators would forget his earlier promises, so he waited before approaching Parliament. And as he waited, he worked, once again, on burnishing his reputation as a philanthropist and humanitarian. People in Europe continued to feel indignant over the Arab slave traders based on Zanzibar and Africa's east coast. The slavers were indeed, it must be said, spreading a wide swath of terror through much of East and Central Africa, and the slaves they captured continued to be sold all along the northeast shore of the Indian Ocean and the Persian Gulf. But European righteousness over the issue was more intertwined than ever with a growing desire for African colonies. Conveniently, the slave traders were mostly Muslim, which allowed Europeans to feel still more virtuous about their ambitions. Leopold won much praise for his patronage of Christian missionaries in his new colony. He so impressed people with his vigorous denunciations of the slave trade that he was elected honorary president of the Aborigines Protection Society, a venerable British human rights organization. To the king's great satisfaction, Brussels was chosen as the location for 8 months of intermittent meetings, starting in November 1889, for an anti-slavery conference of the major powers. The humanitarian king happily entertained the delegates, in whose meeting room at the Belgian Foreign Ministry a forked slave yoke was on display. "It is hard work," the senior British representative reported back to the Foreign Office, "all the dinners, receptions and balls." For diplomatic reasons, Turkey had to be included in the anti-slavery conference, even though slavery was legal there. Its delegate roared with laughter when speakers denounced the Islamic harem as a stimulus to the slave trade. For the diplomats, the conference was a long party. Their conference room looked out on a fashionable downtown street, and one official recalled of Count von Kefenhuller, the Austro-Hungarian representative, Upon the appearance of each woman's hat, he got up and rushed to the window as if moved by a spring, and each time it was the occasion for great joy. Finally, for fear that he would miss a chance for his favourite sport, people from one end of the green-covered table to the other called out to alert him to the approach of a new pretty woman. The anti-slavery conference was a boon to Leopold, for the delegates paused from ogling the passers-by long enough to approve some plans the king proposed for fighting the slave traders. Plans that, it happened, bore a striking resemblance to those for the expensive transportation infrastructure he was hoping to build in the Congo. The king described the need for fortified posts, roads, railways, and steamboats, all of which would support columns of troops pursuing the slavers. He grandly offered the services of the new Congo state towards this noble end, and asked in return only that the conference authorize him to levy import duties to finance the attack on slavery. The powers eventually agreed, in effect amending in Leopold's favour the Berlin Agreement, which had guaranteed free trade. Henry Shelton Sanford, who attended the anti-slavery conference as an American delegate, was horrified. 6 years earlier, he had won United States recognition for Leopold's Congo. In exchange for his own signature on an agreement promising free trade, here was Leopold suddenly asking for customs duties. His naive admiration shattered, Sanford felt that the king had betrayed him. Troubled by gout and insomnia, his chestnut beard now turning grey, and his face showing the effects of age and financial worries, Sanford was a different man from the glamorous, top-hatted envoy of half a dozen years before. Troubled by gout and insomnia, his chestnut beard now turning grey, and his face showing the effects of age and financial worries, Sanford was a different man from the glamorous, top-hatted envoy of half a dozen years before. He died the year after the conference ended, bitterly disillusioned with Leopold and deeply in debt. His Congo investments came to nothing, and the only sign that remained of him there was a 6-ton steamboat called the General Sanford. While the conference was still in session, Leopold invited Stanley to Belgium for a week. Stanley spoke to the delegates, and Leopold presented him with the Grand Cross of the Congo, arranged a banquet and a gala opera performance in his honour, and put him up in the gilt and scarlet rooms at the Royal Palace, normally reserved for visiting royalty. In return, Stanley praised his host to the Belgians in a speech. "What does the greatness of a monarch consist in? If it is the extent of his territory, then the Emperor of Russia is the greatest of all. If it is the splendour and power of military organisation, then William II of Germany takes first place. But if royal greatness consists in the wisdom and goodness of a sovereign leading his people with the solicitude of a shepherd watching over his flock, then the greatest sovereign is your own." Leopold was using Stanley as a modern American president might bring a famous movie star on the campaign trail. Stanley's visit to Brussels was a key part of a carefully planned public relations campaign to mark the 25th year of the king's reign. Leopold also gave a garden party for 2,500 members of the Belgian elite at Laeken, and opened for the awed partygoers the chateau's enormous new glass-domed greenhouses, whose exotic array of plants and trees constituted the largest private botanical collection in the world. Even the Brussels Stock Exchange, whose members had long been reluctant to put up money for the king's African projects, now gave a big reception in his honour, decorating the exchange hall with African spears and one of the more unusual flower arrangements on record, a mass of foliage sprouting 400 elephant tusks. Leopold's campaign was directed toward one goal, money. As his efforts neared a climax, he struck a deal with important members of the cabinet, who were beginning to realize that the king's African possession might someday be quite valuable. If Parliament gave him the loan he wanted, Leopold declared, he would leave the Congo to Belgium in his will. And so, when this generous monarch, known as an anti-slavery crusader, praised by the famous explorer Stanley, feted by his loyal subjects, at last asked Parliament for a loan of 25 million francs, some $125 million in today's money, to support the philanthropic work he was doing in the Congo, he got it. Interest-free. Perhaps nowhere does Leopold's breathtaking arrogance show so clearly as in the curious document where he blithely bequeaths one of his countries to the other. "We, Leopold II, King of the Belgians, sovereign of the État indépendant du Congo, wishing to secure for our beloved fatherland the fruits of the work which, for many long years, we have been pursuing on the African continent, declare by these presents to bequeath and transmit, after our death, to Belgium, all our sovereign rights over l'état indépendant du Congo. There was one added twist. When the king made public his will, it was backdated, so that his bequest looked like an act of generosity instead of part of a financial bargain. For Henry Morton Stanley, the 5 years preceding his red carpet 1890 visit to Brussels had not been easy. From the time the Berlin Conference ended in 1885, Leopold had been wondering what to do with Stanley. To ensure that the explorer would not go to work for the British, he kept him on retainer as a consultant. What the king needed now, however, was not explorers, but surveyors, mining engineers, railway builders, steamboat captains, soldiers, and administrators. Years earlier, Leopold had promised to appoint Stanley Director General of the future Congo state. Then, however, in return for recognition of his Congo by the French, who resented Stanley for out-exploring and belittling their man de Brazza, he had quietly promised them that he would never again employ Stanley in the Congo. In everything but public relations, the restless Stanley was now of little use to the king. Leopold, a Belgian prime minister once remarked, treats men as we use lemons. When he has squeezed them dry, he throws away the peel. Stanley guessed that Leopold had made a secret deal with the French, and, as so often in his life, felt hurt. His African travel equipment was packed and ready, but there was no mission to go on. He didn't need the money he received from being on Leopold's payroll. He was earning far greater sums from his lectures and books. Nonetheless, he maintained his star-struck loyalty to the king, even when Leopold continued to put him off by saying, as Stanley complained in an 1886 letter, "We do not know exactly when we shall need you, but we shall let you know, my dear Mr. Stanley, in ample time to prepare." As always, when he hoped to leave for Africa, Stanley thought about marriage, even though, as he confessed despairingly, "The fact is, I can't talk to women." For more than a year, he carried on another of his shy, clumsy courtships, this time with a London High Society painter named Dorothy Tennant. She painted Greek nymphs, London street urchins, and Stanley's own portrait. It seemed an appropriate match, for she was as stiff and ill at ease with men as Stanley was with women. At the age of 34, she still shared a bedroom with her mother and addressed her diary to her long-dead father. Stanley confided to Tennant the unhappy story of his abandonment by Alice Pike, and then proposed to her. But she turned him down. Once again rejected, he was convinced that Dorothy Tennant held his class origins against him. "That woman entrapped me with her gush," he wrote to a friend, "and her fulsome adulations, her knick-knacks inscribed with 'Remember me,' her sweet-scented notes." While Stanley was suffering through this experience, Leopold's ambitions had grown. His desire for colonies inflamed, he was now dreaming of the Valley of the Nile. "My dear minister," he once said to the Belgian prime minister, who was trying to talk him out of this fantasy, "do you consider worth nothing the glory of being a pharaoh?" Compared with this, he insisted, the Congo was prosaic. But of the Nile, he exclaimed, "It is my panache, and I will never give it up." In 1886, an opportunity appeared that promised Leopold, all in one swoop, the chance to advance his Nile dreams, to see Stanley put to work again, and to consolidate his hold on the Congo. The Sudan, through which the upper branches of the Nile flowed, was under joint Anglo-Egyptian rule. But distances were vast and control loose. Members of a rebel Muslim fundamentalist movement, the Mahdists, staged a rebellion in the mid-1880s, killing the British Governor-General and rebuffing the British forces sent against them. England was shocked, but the country had too many colonial wars underway elsewhere and decided, for the moment, not to fight this one. The rebels pushed to the south, where, holding out against them, was the governor of the Sudan's southernmost province. Most conveniently for Leopold, it bordered on the Congo. The governor, Emin Pasha, asked for help from Europe. One of his letters was published in the Times, and a movement arose to send a private expedition to support him. The Times said it would be an errand of mercy and of peril to rescue Emin Pasha, who is surrounded by savage and hostile tribes and cut off from the reach and resources of civilization. Fueled by anti-Islamic fervor, the plan won a large following. The British were further outraged with the Mahdists when their leader demanded that Queen Victoria come to the Sudan, submit to his rule, and convert to Islam. Now the British had not only Muslim villains, but in Emin, a white hero. For despite his title, Emin means the faithful one, the beleaguered Pasha was a slight, short German Jew, originally named Eduard Schnitzer. In photographs, Emin's unmistakably European face, adorned with thick spectacles and topped with a red fez, looks like that of a nearsighted delegate to a Shriners convention. A physician by training, the Pasha was a brilliant linguist and an eccentric. Besides trying to govern his province, heal the sick, and hold out against the Mahdist rebels, he was painstakingly gathering specimens of plant and animal life, and assembling a collection of stuffed birds for the British Museum. Plans for the relief expedition took shape, and donations poured in. The food merchants, Fortnum and Mason, contributed cases of delicacies. The inventor, Hiram Maxim, sent the very latest model of his machine gun. Also destined for Emin was a new dress uniform. And to lead the Emin Pasha relief expedition, who was a more suitable choice than Henry Morton Stanley? The explorer eagerly accepted the invitation. He was particularly delighted by the Maxim gun, which he tried out at its maker's home, satisfying himself that it really could shoot the advertised 600 rounds per minute. The new gun, Stanley said, would be of valuable service in helping civilization to overcome barbarism. When Stanley asked Leopold to release him from the consulting contract so that he could lead the expedition, the king agreed, on two conditions. First, instead of travelling to Emin by the shorter, easier route leading from the East African coast through German and British Highland Territory, the expedition was to go through Leopold's Congo, which would require its crossing the unexplored Ituri rainforest. Second, once Stanley found Emin Pasha, he would ask him to remain the governor of his province, but as a province of the Congo state. Leopold would thus get not only an unknown corner of his territory explored and perhaps enlarged, he would have it all done at other people's expense. The financing for the venture came from sources ranging from the Royal Geographical Society to British traders interested in Emin's rumoured stash of £60,000 worth of ivory to press barons who knew that a new Stanley expedition would sell newspapers. As he departed in early 1887, the explorer adroitly juggled the demands of his many sponsors. A surprised witness who later came upon Stanley and his huge force marching around the lower rapids of the Congo River noticed that the standard-bearer at the head of the column was carrying, at the request of New York Herald publisher James Gordon Bennett, Jr., the flag of the New York Yacht Club. Stanley's usual two-volume, thousand-page bestseller turned out to be only one of many books subsequently written about the Emin Pasha relief expedition. In recruiting his officers, Stanley made each one sign a contract promising that no book he wrote would appear until 6 months after Stanley's official account. But other than benefiting the press and the publishing industry, the expedition proved a disaster for almost everyone involved, except, perhaps, for the New York Yacht Club, which at least had its banner borne across a continent. Stanley threw his usual temper tantrums. 4 times he fired his personal manservant, and 4 times took him back. He had screaming matches with his white officers, several of whom later painted a highly unglamorous picture of Stanley. "The slightest little thing," one wrote, "is sufficient to work him into a frenzy of rage." He compounded the problems of Henry Sanford's collapsing Congo business venture by commandeering its partly built steamboat as a barge for his troops, and returning it several months later badly damaged. Most important, he made the strategic mistake of dividing his 800 soldiers, porters, and camp followers into 2 columns, so that he, with a smaller, faster-moving force, would reach Emin Pasha and accomplish the dramatic, headline-catching rescue more quickly. As always, Stanley bungled his choice of subordinates. The officer he left in charge of the rear column, Major Edmund Bartolo, promptly lost his mind. He sent Stanley's personal baggage down the river. He dispatched another officer on a bizarre 3,000-mile, 3-month round trip to the nearest telegraph station to send a senseless telegram to England. He next decided that he was being poisoned and saw traitors on all sides. He had one of them given 300 lashes, which proved fatal. He jabbed at Africans with a steel-tipped cane, ordered several dozen people put in chains, and bit a village woman. An African shot and killed Bartolo before he could do more. Stanley, meanwhile, slogged through the rainforest at the head of the vanguard column, sentencing a deserter to be hanged and ordering numerous floggings, some of which he administered himself. Supply snafus meant that much of the time his porters and soldiers were near starvation. To those unfortunate enough to live in its path, the expedition felt like an invading army, for it sometimes held women and children hostage until local chiefs supplied food. One of Stanley officers wrote in his diary, "We finished our last plantain today. The natives do not trade or offer to in the least. As a last resort, we must catch some more of their women." When it seemed that they might be attacked, another recalled, Stanley gave the order to burn all the villages round. Another described the slaughter as casually as if it were a hunt. It was most interesting lying in the bush watching the natives quietly at their day's work. Some women were making banana flour by pounding up dried bananas. Men we could see building huts and engaged in other work, boys and girls running about singing. I opened the game by shooting one chap through the chest. He fell like a stone. Immediately a volley was poured into the village. One member of the expedition packed the severed head of an African in a box of salt and sent it to London to be stuffed and mounted by his Piccadilly taxidermist. Of the 389 men in Stanley's vanguard, more than half died as they hacked their way with machetes through the Ituri rainforest, sometimes making only 400 yards progress a day. When they ran out of food, they roasted ants. They climbed over giant tree roots and had to pitch camp on swampy ground in the midst of tropical downpours, one of which lasted 17 hours without interruption. Men deserted, got lost in the jungle, drowned, or succumbed to tetanus, dysentery, and gangrenous ulcers. Others were killed by the arrows and poisoned snake traps of forest dwellers, terrified by these armed, starving strangers rampaging through their territory. By the time they finally reached Emin, Stanley and his surviving men were hungry and exhausted. Because most of the supplies were hundreds of miles behind them, with the rear column and its mad commander, the explorer could offer the diminutive Pasha little except some ammunition, fan mail, several bottles of champagne, and the new dress uniform, which turned out to be much too large. In fact, it was Stanley who had to ask Emin for supplies. The Pasha met them, Stanley wrote, in a clean suit of snowy cotton drilling, well ironed and of perfect fit, his face showing not a trace of ill health or anxiety. It rather indicated good condition of body and peace of mind. Emin, still happily gathering specimens for the British Museum, politely declined Leopold's proposal to join his province to the new Congo state. Most embarrassing of all to the bedraggled vanguard of the Emin Pasha relief expedition, the rebel threat had eased since Emin's letters of several years earlier, and he turned out not to be eager for relief. Stanley greatly feared returning home without Emin. The Pasha wrote in his diary, "For him, everything depends on whether he is able to take me along, for only then would his expedition be regarded as totally successful. He would rather perish than leave without me." Stanley did at last succeed in persuading the reluctant Pasha to head back to Europe with him, in part because the very arrival of the relief expedition's large, trigger-happy force stirred up the Mahdist rebels all over again. So Stanley and Emin and their followers trekked for several months to the East African coast, reaching the sea at a small German post in today's Tanzania. A German battery fired an artillery salute in their honour, and officials gave the two of them a banquet at the local officers' mess. A naval band played. Stanley, Emin, and a German major gave speeches. "The wines were choice and well selected and iced," writes Stanley. Then the near-sighted Emin, who had been moving up and down the banquet table, chatting with the guests and drinking champagne, stepped through a second-floor window that he apparently thought opened on a veranda. It didn't. He fell to the street and was knocked unconscious. He had to remain in a local German hospital for 2 months, and Stanley was unable to bring him back to Europe in triumph. Most embarrassing of all for Stanley was that Emin Pasha, once he recovered, went to work neither for his British rescuers nor for Leopold, but for the Germans. For some months after Stanley's return in 1890, a controversy boiled in England over the loss of more than half the expedition's men, and over the atrocities committed under his command. One weekly lampooned him, "And when the heat of Afric's sun grew quite too enervating, some bloodshed with the Maxim gun was most exhilarating." The Emin Pasha relief expedition had indeed been brutal. But those who condemned it were unaware that, compared with the bloodshed beginning just then in Central Africa, it was only a sideshow. Chapter 7. The First Heretic. Leopold's will treated the Congo as if it were just a piece of uninhabited real estate to be disposed of by its owner. In this, the king was no different from other Europeans of his age, explorers, journalists, and empire builders alike, who talked of Africa as if it were without Africans, an expanse of empty space waiting to be filled by the cities and railway lines constructed through the magic of European industry. To see Africa instead as a continent of coherent societies, each with its own culture and history, took a leap of empathy, a leap that few, if any, of the early European or American visitors to the Congo were able to make. To do so would have meant seeing Leopold's regime not as progress, not as civilization, but as a theft of land and freedom. For the first time, however, a visitor now arrives in the Congo who sees the colony around him with such eyes. Let us catch up with him at a station on the banks of the Congo River, on the muggy mid-July day in 1890 when he first puts his feelings on paper. There are now a number of Leopold stations on the river network, each a combination of military base and collecting point for ivory. Typically, a few buildings with thatched roofs and shady verandas sheltered by palm trees provide sleeping quarters for white officials. From a pole flies the blue flag with the gold star. Some food comes from banana trees, a garden growing manioc and other vegetables, and pens for chickens, goats, or pigs. A wooden blockhouse with rifle ports atop a small man-made hillock provides defense. Often there is a stockade as well. Elephant tusks lie in a shed or in the open, guarded by armed sentries and awaiting transport to the coast. African dugout canoes are drawn up on the riverbank beside piles of wood cut in short lengths for steamboat boilers. One of the most important stations is 1,000 miles upstream from Leopoldville at Stanley Falls, the upper limit of navigation on the main stretch of the Congo River. At the Stanley Falls station on this July day, a 40-year-old man sits down in a white-hot blaze of anger. In a graceful, energetic hand, he begins writing. Perhaps he sits outside, his back against a palm trunk. Perhaps he borrows the desk of the station clerk. As we can see in a handful of stiff, formal portrait photos we have of him, his hair is cropped short, his moustache tapers to long tips, he wears a bow tie and a high, white, starched collar. Maybe it is too hot for the collar and tie this day on the river bank, but maybe not. Some visitors dress formally in the Congo at all times. The document that flows from the man's pen over the next day or two is a milestone in the literature of human rights and of investigative journalism. It is entitled, An Open Letter to His Serene Majesty Leopold II, King of the Belgians and Sovereign of the Independent State of Congo, by Colonel the Honorable George W. Williams of the United States of America. George Washington Williams was indeed an American. He was not, however, a colonel, a claim that was to cause him problems later. And he was black. Largely because of that, he has long been ignored. Among the eager throng of visitors drawn to the Congo as Leopold began to exploit it, Williams became the first great dissenter. And, like many travellers who find themselves in a moral inferno, he had begun in search of something he hoped would be more like paradise. Williams had come to the Congo over a route that seems almost as if it had taken him through several different lives. Born in Pennsylvania in 1849, he had only scanty schooling, and in 1864 he enlisted, semi-literate, underage, and with an assumed name, in the 41st U.S. Colored Troops of the Union Army. He fought in several battles during the drive on Richmond and Petersburg in the closing months of the war, and was wounded in combat. Afterward, like some other Civil War veterans in search of work, he enlisted in the Army of the Republic of Mexico, which was fighting to overthrow King Leopold II's ambitious but unlucky brother-in-law, Emperor Maximilian. When he returned home with no job skills except soldiering, Williams re-enlisted in the U.S. Army and passed the better part of a year with a cavalry regiment fighting the Plains Indians. Sometime during the second half of 1867, when they both spent time at various army posts in Kansas, Williams' path may have crossed that of a young newspaper correspondent, Henry Morton Stanley. After leaving the army the next year, Williams studied briefly at Howard University, which, when he mentioned it in later years, sometimes came out sounding like Harvard University. Later in his life, he also claimed a doctoral degree he had never earned. He was a brilliant student, however, and, moving on to the Newton Theological Institution outside Boston, managed to compress a 3-year graduate theology curriculum into 2. In letters he wrote just after his army days, barely a word is spelled correctly, and the sentences are painfully garbled. But a few years later, he could compose fluently in the rolling cadences of the 19th century pulpit. A speech he gave when he graduated from Newton in 1874 sounded the theme that would lead him to the Congo 16 years later. For nearly 3 centuries, Africa has been robbed of her sable sons. The Negro of this country can turn to his Saxon brothers and say, as Joseph said to his brethren who wickedly sold him, "We, after learning your arts and sciences, might return to Egypt and deliver the rest of our brethren who are yet in the house of bondage." That day will come. Williams had already begun